In. But I am delighted to be here, so thrilled to finally meet the people that Val and Walt have been talking about for a month. And you can't imagine how enthusiastic their letters have been since they came to Laurel. It's just so manifestly the will of God that they're here. And I think a good illustration of what I'm going to talk about tonight, which is a pattern for good. I take my title from Philip's translation of the same passage that Walt read a minute ago in Romans 8. The 28th chapter, the 28th verse of Romans 8 says, "Everything that happens fits into a pattern for good." And although a person without faith looking at the events of my life might have a difficult time seeing how in the world I could regard some of those things as good, the eye of faith sees things on a different level, doesn't it? And I trust that you won't think of my talk tonight as being a list of sad stories, but you will remember that there's another whole level on which all of the things that happen in this world are to be interpreted and understood. I want to read to you first from a fascinating article in the National Geographic that appeared, several years ago, called The New Biology. I don't know anything at all about biology, but those of you who read the National Geographic would agree that they know how to make things available to people who don't know anything. And this was an article on DNA, which they defined as the master choreographer of the living cell and carrier of the genetic code. Just a few staggering facts from this article. All the genes in all the cells of a human body would fit into a block the size of an ice cube. Yet if all this DNA were unwound and joined, the string would stretch from the earth to the sun and back more than 400 times. Each cell has 200 trillion molecules. The cell has turned out to be a micro-universe, science now tells us, abounding with discrete pieces of life, each performing with exquisite precision, and often in thousandths of a second, a biochemical dance. During a given moment in the life of a cell, thousands of events are being precisely coordinated at the molecular level. Now, who runs that show? Who coordinates thousands of events at the molecular level? 200 trillion molecules in a cell. We know who does it. The one who's got the whole wide world in his hands. Who's got the tiny little babies and you and me, brother, in his hands. And I believe with all my heart that the God who can coordinate those thousands of events every second on the molecular level is also the God whose hand formed the stars, who keeps those galaxies wheeling in perfect timing, perfect harmony, perfect coordination, and who coordinates the events of my life according to his divine and sometimes incomprehensible purposes. In the passage that Walt read, we're told exactly what his purpose is. He has predestined us to be conformed to his image, to become like Jesus Christ. And only the kind of God who could harmonize this kind of universe knows exactly what it takes to bring me into conformity with the image of Christ. He knows what it takes to bring you into that kind of conformity. I sat one day about nearly 20 years ago in a little house in the jungle of Ecuador, the eastern jungle, a house that had split bamboo walls, a palm floor, and a thatched roof. To me, this house was a palace, because I had spent the previous year living in a house with no walls, no floors, and no furniture. It was six poles with a thatched roof and nothing more. Well, after you've lived in that kind of a house, believe me, to have a split palm floor, even if it waves when you walk across it and things that are on the table wobble, and even if you can see through the cracks in the bamboo which make up the walls, it seems like a palace. And I was very grateful for that. I was living with the Auca Indians, A-U-C-A, Auca. And they had been known to be a very savage and primitive tribe, people whom no white person had ever contacted and come out alive. In fact, no other Indian tribe had ever contacted them and escaped alive. So remote that they had never seen even a stranger, let alone a white person, let alone a white woman. Here I was sitting in my hammock in, quote, the living room, unquote, of this little tiny house. It actually had three rooms, believe it or not. I had a bedroom and Valerie had a bedroom. And then the rest of it was sort of living room, kitchen, dining room. And sitting on the floor beside my hammock was a man by the name of Gikita, a naked man wearing around his hips a string. Now, of course, when I first went in to live with these Indians called the Aucas, I asked the question that any foreigner would ask, why do you wear that string? And in utter astonishment and surprise, he looked at me and he said, well, you certainly wouldn't expect us to go around naked. All of them wore just a string. And I mean a string. I don't mean a G-string. I mean literally a piece of string around their hips. Well, Gikita was sitting there quite at home on the floor of my little house, holding in his hand a tiny little plastic microphone, which was attached to a very small tape recorder. This was in the very beginnings of tape recorders, and this was a very primitive little instrument compared to the beautiful, finely tuned ones that we can buy today. And it ran on four standard flashlight batteries. It was amazing to me how these Indians had taken to mechanical things without any difficulty at all, and they enjoyed very much talking into the microphone of this tape recorder. And the sort of things that Gikita was saying into that microphone were butu what the tanamon dominani guwurinani yeah. Now, can you imagine writing that down? This was a language which had never been written down in any form. Part of my object in becoming a missionary was to go to tribes which had unwritten languages with a view ultimately to reducing those languages to writing in order that I might translate the Bible into those languages. And this was the third Indian tribal language that I had had the opportunity of working on, but this was by far the most difficult. It was not a dialect, it was a language, and it had no more connection with the other languages that I had learned than Chinese has with English. And one of the difficulties that I was up against was that no Indian was ever prepared to repeat precisely the same way any phrase or any single word. In the first place, they thought that everybody is born speaking Auca. Did it ever occur to you that none of us remembers the process of learning our mother tongue? And if you are so isolated and so uneducated as to never have heard a foreign language or never have heard of a foreign language, you would imagine that this is something with which we are all born. And so the fact that I did not speak Auca could only prove to the Indians that I was retarded. And to try to get across to them exactly what it was that I was trying to do was very difficult. And all you can do to reduce an unwritten language to writing is to sit there and try to write down what people say. You don't have any textbooks, you don't have any interpreter because there's no other language into which it can be interpreted. You can't buy Berlitz school records or anything of that sort. So I would be sitting there with my little notebook and making tapes, which I would very laboriously transcribe. I discovered that the only way in which I could get an exact repetition of what somebody had said was by a tape recorder. And so here was Gikita sitting there talking into the microphone, saying things like that. Now, I'll repeat what I said to you a minute ago, and you just try to imagine writing that down without getting a repetition the second time. Butto, what the animal, dominani, good woody nani, yeah, wananita. Now that means, and so I speared them, and those foreigners died. Gikita was telling me the story on tape of how he and four other Alka Indians had speared my husband to death. Back in 1956, before some of you were born, but there are people here I see that are old enough to remember back that far, there were five American missionaries who had attempted to reach this tribe of Indians with the gospel. Knowing that they had never heard the gospel, believing that the commission of Jesus Christ is go ye into all the world and preach the gospel, they had prayed for years that God would open a door into that little tribe, and finally the day came in the fall of 1955 when Nate Saint, the pilot who served those mission stations in the eastern jungle of Ecuador, discovered an inhabited Alka house. Many times he had flown over and found what he thought was probably an Alka house, but it had been abandoned. And it took him years of flying back and forth in a crisscross pattern over the jungle before he finally came across a house that had some real live Indians running around outside. And the fact that they were not wearing clothes proved that they were Alkas, because the other tribes in Ecuador were clothed. And with great joy and excitement, he came to our station to tell Jim and me that he had found an inhabited Alka house. And God began to work in those men and to give them the desire to make an attempt to reach the Alkas on the ground. Now, before I go ahead with the Alka story, let's take some more background to how the events of Nate Saint's and Jim Elliott's lives were precisely coordinated to bring them to this point. Back in the 1940s, the late 1940s, my brother Dave Howard was on the wrestling team at Wheaton. And the star of that particular wrestling team was a man by the name of Jim Elliott. Well, Dave was my younger brother, and he was always telling me about the guys on the team, and he especially talked about Jim Elliott, and he was always saying, "You've got to meet this guy, Elliott." Well, I wasn't all that excited about my little brother's friends, and so it took a while before I met him. But the day finally came when we did meet. It was during my junior year for the first time, but I didn't see much of him until my senior year. And another one of the events which I believe Almighty God had coordinated was that Jim and I were both Greek majors in college, both of us for the same reason. We believed that God had called us to foreign missionary work, specifically to Bible translation work, and obviously the study of the Greek language is helpful in translating the New Testament. And so we ended up in the year of 1947 and 48 being in the same classes. And I was also a member of the Foreign Missions Fellowship, and Jim Elliott turned out to be the president of the Foreign Missions Fellowship. And what with one thing and another, our paths began to cross rather frequently. And I became aware, I thought, that perhaps Jim was making more than a necessary effort to sit next to me in some of these classes. But then I thought, forget it, there isn't a chance in the world that a man as attractive as Jim would ever be looking at you, you wallflower. And Jim was a very popular man, but also known as a woman hater. He was not a woman hater, but not by a long shot. In fact, he was so attracted by women that he had made a rule for himself when he first started college. If he was going to get the BA degree and also the degree that he called AUG, a degree not listed in any college catalog, which he got from Paul's epistle, approved unto God. That was the primary degree that Jim was after. He decided that if he was going to earn that degree, it was going to take some sacrifice. It was going to take some concentration. And among the distractions which he decided that he could eliminate from his life was dating. He just decided that for 3 or 4 years of college, he would stick to business and not bother with girls, to our great sorrow. And of course, this made him much more attractive, much more desirable to all the women on campus, the fact that everybody knew they couldn't get him. Well, I wasn't the type that tried to get them. You know, I could do a lot of praying, but I certainly wasn't going to go out and make any overt efforts. And so I began to think that maybe he was slightly interested, but then I thought there isn't a chance. Well, my brother invited him home for Christmas. And Jim and I found ourselves sitting up till all hours of the morning talking. And as we talked, we discovered one area after another in which our interests matched. And we discovered many things in common. But nothing was said about personal feelings. until just about a week before I was about to graduate. And at that point, Jim stunned me by telling me that he was in love with me. But he stunned me even more by telling me that he believed that God was calling him to the mission field single. Well, I believe that God had also brought me through a period of spiritual exercise in which I was finally able to say to the Lord, "Yes, Lord, I will go to the mission field. Yes, Lord, I will go single if you want me to." Certainly was not the life that I would have chosen. But when I made that commitment, it was really a hypothetical one. After all, if there's no real live man on the horizon, it's one thing to say, "Yes, Lord, I'll go single." And if a man shows up, then the validity of that commitment is severely tested. After all, we can make hypothetical vows to God, can't we? You've probably heard, some of you, this gospel song, "I'd rather have Jesus than silver or gold. I'd rather have Jesus than to be the king of a vast domain. But may I see the hands of those who have had that kind of an option." You know, it's a hypothetical kind of commitment. And that's what mine was, that my willingness to be single, until God saw fit to test us by allowing us to fall in love with each other. Well, we might have leaped to conclusions and decided that since God had allowed this to happen, that surely he intended for us to get married, but both of us felt that that was a pretty dangerous conclusion to draw quickly. And so we committed the whole thing back to God, agreed to separate for an indefinite period. We thought perhaps forever. Jim lived in Oregon, I lived in New Jersey. The chances of our paths crossing in the natural course of events did not seem very likely. And to make a long story short, we both ended up in Ecuador. I on the east, on the west side of the Andes, and Jim on the east side of the Andes, still unengaged, uncommitted. And this was more than 4 years after my graduation from college. In the providence of God, however, he did bring us together after a series of what seemed to us cataclysmic events. I had been working in a small tribe of Indians called the Colorados on the west side of the Andes, a tribe also with an unwritten language, and the first test of my faith as a missionary was when my informant, a man by the name of Macario, who was giving me regular classes or lessons, as it were, in the Colorado language. He was a white man who spoke both Colorado and Spanish and consequently was a tremendous help to me as an informant since I didn't have to use a monolingual approach. Macario was killed. This was a stunning blow because it didn't fit in with my categories of how things were supposed to work. And I had to choose at that point either to believe that God was still coordinating the events of my life and fitting everything into a pattern for good, or I had to decide that I was at the mercy of chance, that God is not sovereign, that I might as well pack my bags and go home. You know, there are really only two choices. You either trust God or you don't trust God. And when we've made a lifetime commitment to trust God, then he tests us again and again and again. He says, "You trusted me back here. Okay, how about now?" All right, you might pass that test. And he says, "And what about now?" And the lessons are never ended, are they? Not as long as we're here in this flesh, because we are always tempted to doubt. Doubt becomes a habit and a luxury, a habit that we must kick as Christians. So God brought me through that test. I said, "Yes, Lord, I don't know why you allowed it. It doesn't make sense to me. It doesn't fit any of my categories, but I do believe that you know what you're doing. I'm going to trust you." The next thing that happened was that all of the materials that I had spent an entire year on, all the charts, all the notebooks, all the vocabulary cards, were in a suitcase which was being transported on top of a banana truck, and the suitcase was stolen. Now, what would you do? There were no copies of anything. This was in the days before Xerox and before tape recorders. What would you do? Of course, you would pray, wouldn't you, that God would return that suitcase to you somehow. And that's exactly what we did. We prayed. And guess what? He didn't return the suitcase. Everything that I had done in that year was down the drain. But Romans 8:28 is still in the book. Everything that happens fits into a pattern for good. Now, I'd love to be able to explain to you tonight why Mercadio was murdered and why my language materials were all stolen. I can't give you any human reasons. I do know that it was part of the process of making me conformable to the image of Christ, and the Lord is a long way from finishing that process. It forced me to trust God for who He is and to say, "Yes, Lord, I believe it." Even if you never demonstrate to me here in this life your reasons. The third thing that happened was that Jim had been working on a station during that whole year when I was working on the other side of the Andes. He had been rebuilding three buildings that had been dilapidated. A mission station had had to be abandoned. And he had built two new buildings, a school and a clinic. And in one night, all five buildings were swept down the river in a flood. It was as though, with one sweep of God's hand, everything that I had done went down the drain. Everything that Jim had done went down the Amazon, quite literally. And of course, we could pray. We really didn't expect God to bring those buildings back up over the cliff. We simply trusted that God knew what He was doing. Shortly after the flood, God brought us together. The verse that He gave us when we were married on our wedding day was, "Lo, this is our God. We have waited for Him." We had waited 5.5 years for His green light. In 1955, we were married in 1953, and in 1955, we had a little daughter born whose name was Valerie. And Valerie was 10 months old when her father made an attempt to reach these Alca Indians. You know the end of the story. The men had trusted God at every single point through the entire 3 or 4 months of dropping gifts to those Alca Indians to prove their friendship, praying that God would specifically show them how they should make an entrance, when they should make an entrance, who should go. Jim and I had first thought that the three of us would go, he and Valerie and I, by canoe, and then it was decided that an attempt could be made to land the airplane on a sand strip in Alca territory, and when that was discovered, then the five men planned to go together. And as they went, they sang that hymn by Edith G. Cherry, "We Rest on Thee, Our Shield and Our Defender." And I want you to ask yourself tonight if it fits into your categories of the way God does things, that He would allow five obedient servants of His to trust Him to be their shield and would then allow them to be speared to death. What kind of a God do we serve? He was the God who delivered Daniel from the lion's jaws, walked with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the midst of the fiery furnace. He was the God who could open bars of iron and gates of brass and release from prison Paul and Silas and Peter. But He was also the God who allowed John the Baptist to have his head chopped off. The God who was silent when they stoned His faithful witness, Stephen, to death. And the God who restrained Himself when they nailed His own son to a cross. I had to believe that everything that happens fits into a pattern for good. And the words that came to me when I received a radio message that my husband was missing were from Isaiah 43, Verse 2, and it is from that passage that the third stanza of the hymn we sang tonight, "How Firm a Foundation," is taken. "When through the deep waters I call thee to go, the rivers of sorrow shall not overflow. For For I will be with thee thy trials to bless, and sanctify to thee thy deepest distress. And the words came to me from Isaiah 43:2, when thou passest through the waters, I will be with thee. He was with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the furnace. He was with Joseph in the prison. He was with Daniel in the lion's den. He was with John the Baptist. He was with Stephen. But there were different outcomes, weren't there, to those stories. Everything that happens fits into a pattern for good. After Jim was killed, and incidentally, can you imagine that Jim and I would have had the faith and the patience and the courage to wait for 5.5 years if we had known that our marriage was only going to last 27 months? God doesn't show us a blueprint for our whole lives. He says, one day at a time. Thy word is a lamp unto my feet. And if we obey and take that one step, then he shows us the next one. And he gives us the grace for each step as we take it. And I prayed after Jim died, Lord, if there's any way in the world that you can send me to the Alcas, here I am. It seemed like a ridiculous prayer to pray. After all, with a 10-month-old baby, what was I going to do? A widow. I had my own work cut out for me, working on the station with Quechua Indians, where Jim and I had been together. If 5 men had apparently failed in this attempt, how could a widow with a baby possibly succeed? But you know, we pray some ridiculous prayers at times, and God does take us up on them. And so I simply said, Lord, here I am. Anything you want to do about it, you're going to have to make unmistakably clear to me, because I don't have any suggestions as to how you could ever send me to the Alcas. It happened that in 1957, about a year and a half after the death of Jim and the other 4 men, I was in a place where I would not normally be, a station called Arahuno, which was the closest mission station to Alca territory. I didn't want to be there. I had received an invitation from a missionary who was going to leave his wife in the jungle for a few days, and she was not a woman who liked to be left on her own in a jungle station. And he called me on the radio and he said, would you mind coming over and staying with her for a few days? Well, I didn't really want to leave my station, didn't want to go over there at all, but I prayed about it instead of saying no immediately, and I believed that God wanted me to go. And so I went, and I hadn't been there more than a day when 2 Quechua Indians from a more remote station arrived at our doorstep to announce that there were 2 Alca women at their house. I couldn't believe my ears. Alcas never came out to Quechua houses. There had been no contact of any kind between Alcas and anybody outside. And of course, these Indians had no idea why they were there, because they couldn't speak their language. But they said, do you want to come with us and see them? You've got 5 minutes to make up your mind. We have to leave. It's 12 noon. It takes us 6 hours to get home. It gets dark at 6 o'clock. Let's go. So I had about 5 minutes to make up my mind. I sent up a very fast prayer. Lord, is this what I'm supposed to do? And I believed that he had opened a door which I could not refuse to enter. And so we walked the 6 hours over the trail. I found these 2 Alca women. I couldn't make head or tail out of anything that they were saying. But again, to make a long story short, in the providence of God, they returned with me to my Quechua station. And for almost a year, Valerie and I lived in a Quechua Indian house. We moved out of the civilized house that Jim had built for us, because I felt that this would be rather uncomfortable for 2 Alca women. So we moved into a Quechua house and lived with a Quechua family. And I spent that year trying to learn these women's language. Well, I discovered later on that I could not possibly have had 2 worse informants than Mintaka and Mankamo. They were hopeless in understanding what I was trying to do and in helping me. But by the end of about 9 months, I was able to make out just barely enough of their language to know that they were inviting me to go with them into the Alca tribe. And so, praying earnestly that God would close the door if this was not his will, asking that he guide us very clearly, Valerie and I and Rachel Saint, the sister of Nate the pilot who had been killed, went in with Mintaka and Mankamo. And as I said, I lived for 2 years with this tribe of people. I made up my mind before I got there that I was going to learn exactly what my three-year-old daughter learned in the language every day. After all, I had majored in Greek in college. I had taken linguistics at the University of Oklahoma. I had studied Spanish, Colorado, and Quechua. I had notebooks, a tape recorder, systems of mnemonics, and maybe with all that background, I could keep up with a three-year-old. Well, it was a very naive hope. There was no way that I could keep up with Valerie. And one of the first phrases that she learned, and she learned to say it exactly as the Alka said it, was "Ha, Akam," which means everybody listen to this. And when I was trying to speak Alka, she was sitting there saying, "Ha, Akam." And when I was trying to do things that they were always trying to get me to do, things that any normal adult Alka woman would be able to do without any difficulty, such as making a clay pot or weaving a hammock, or catching fish with my hands, Valerie would be yelling out to the general company, "Kya akam," which means everybody get a load of this. She was no help at all in translation because she had an Alka compartment in her brain. She didn't translate from English into Alka as we adults do when we try to learn a foreign language. We're constantly translating back and forth. A child learns in a mysterious way. I don't know what it is. Circles around me in no time at all. And I found myself the object of much curiosity and a full-time comedian. It had never occurred to me before that I was a comedian, but to the Alkas, everything that I did was laughable. And they would make sound effects accompanying the things that I did. For example, if I walked across a clearing in the morning carrying my little shortwave radio in order to attach it to an aerial, which was on a bamboo pole on the other side of the clearing, the entire group would accompany my steps with sound effects. Well, you feel very silly, you know. Just try to imagine how you would feel with everybody accompanying your steps with sound effects. You don't know whether to keep in time with what they're doing or to quickly change your gait and throw them off. And of course, you try it every way. But God put us there to be his witnesses. Now, if we have a question period following this talk, which I don't know whether we will have, but there may be time, I'm sure that there will be somebody who wants to know what the results were of our time there with the Alkas, and that's a question I can't answer, because I only know that salvation is of the Lord. Only God can assess the spiritual progress of people as simple, as primitive, as remote from my understanding as the Alkas were. But there was no question in my mind that this was a part of God's will for me. And he put us in that place for his own ultimate purposes. Surely it had something to do with the salvation of the Alkas. Surely it has something to do with my perfection in holiness. But there was never any question that all of this was fitting into a pattern for good. Well, I haven't got time to tell you all the rest of the story of my life. I don't need to. God has led in amazing ways, as Walt told you about how I met him, and the fact that through my second husband's illness and death, my daughter found a husband, and I found a third husband is just beyond anything that I could have ever imagined. It's a story that I don't think even Grace Livingston Hill could have dreamed up. As one friend of mine said, after Walt and Lars had lived in the house as lodgers for 2 years, then it was a year later that Walt married Val, and 2 years later that Lars married me, and my friend said, "Well, Walt got Val, and Lars got the old lady." And to me, it's just beyond my imagination. As Lars says, he hopes he lasts longer than the first two. My second husband died of cancer when we had been married for 4.5 years. Just on Thursday, I was in Dallas, Texas, and a young man came up to me, as countless young men have said, "Your husband's biography, Shadow of the Almighty, has had more influence in my life than any other book I've ever read except the Bible." I could not count the number of young men that have said this to me. In fact, he said, "I've read the book about 5 times, and," he said, "each time I finish it, I feel as though I've just lost my dearest friend." But he said, you know, if Jim hadn't been willing to go the whole way, I would never have had him for a friend. And he started to choke up at this point, and the tears filled his eyes, and he said, I don't know how to thank you. Well, I don't know how to say you're welcome to that kind of thing either, because what did I have to do with it? Everything that happens fits into a pattern for good. Now, if Jim had been given the reins and told to do his own thing, to do what he wanted to do, to seek his own self-fulfillment, thousands of people would have been deprived of the testimony which they've had due to his death. But Jim had written in his diary years before, he is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. Jesus said, he that loseth his life for my sake, the same shall find it. Because Jim and four other men really believed in that spiritual principle, losing your life is finding it. Everything that happens fits into a pattern for good, and that pattern is way up here beyond anything that we can see. Because they really believed that, the rest of us are enriched. And as I look back over these crises of my life, there's not one thing that I would change if I could. Not because God has shown me reasons here on earth. He has shown me some of them. He hasn't shown me enough. He hasn't shown me all of them. But because I really believe that that pattern that he's working out is a perfect one. And that when the day comes that that pattern is shown to me, even I am going to be satisfied with the way God did things. I want to close with the words of a little poem that many of you have probably heard Corrie ten Boom quote. I don't know who wrote it. My life is but a weaving betwixt my God and me. I do not choose the colors. He worketh steadily. Oft times he weaveth sorrow. And I, in foolish pride, forget he sees the upper and I the underside.